Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Kenneth Pollack is my first guest this hour. Some of you know that his last book, The Threatening Storm, was crucial in the Bush administration's drive for war against Iraq. That Pollack had been the leading Persian Gulf expert in President Clinton's National Security Council gave him even more weight in that national debate. Knowing all he knows now about Iraq, Pollack has since expressed some regrets about his pre-war role. But now he has a new book, this one focusing on Iran. It's called The Persian Puzzle, The Conflict Between Iran and America, published by Random House. Kenneth Pollack is now with the Brookings Institution. We will also talk to him about the Middle East, the Israeli-Palestinian Middle East, and the broader Middle East after Yasser Arafat. So, Kenneth Pollack, welcome back to WNYC. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back.
And I wonder if you would first take a minute to set the record straight for our listeners. How much do you regret having written The Threatening Storm and making the case for war to rid Saddam of weapons of mass destruction that he apparently didn't have?
Yeah, I've got regret in two ways. First, as typical with most books, a lot of people used the book, a lot of people talked about the book, very few people actually seem to have read the book. And in the book, what I said is, I think that there is a case for a war. I think that a war is going to be necessary, but understand that you're going to have to do a whole bunch of things before you go to war. And in fact, in the run-up to the war, even before we actually invaded Iraq, I made clear that I thought we did not have the international support that we needed. I felt we should have tackled the Middle East peace process first, and I thought we were woefully unprepared for the post-war scenario, including having far too many troops. So even before we went to war, I had a great deal of problems with the way that President Bush took us to war even then. Now, since the war, it's clear that one of the most important arguments that I made for war, one of the things that convinced me when I was in the Clinton administration that a war would be necessary, was the WMD threat. And it is very clear that that threat was far, far more distant than we were led to believe at the time.
So a question that a lot of people in the government then and now must be asking themselves, how did you, with all your experience, get the intelligence as wrong as you did?
Well, first, I was relying on a bunch of, understand, I'm not a nuclear physicist, and I had nuclear physicists coming to me and saying, we think Saddam is restarting his nuclear program, and the best you can do is say, well, why do you think that? What evidence do you have? And they took us through the various pieces of evidence that they have. And for me, the most revealing thing was after the war, to hear about some of the things that CIA, my old organization, was doing, which, in all honesty, I never ever would have thought they would do. In particular, the biggest one was they had sources, these defectors who came from Ahmed Chalabi. They never told us that they were coming from Ahmed Chalabi. And what's more, they were taking information from a single source and disseminating it as if it were from multiple sources. And you know that any journalist, any policymaker, if it comes from more sources, it is much more believable. You remember Colin Powell had the same problem. He went before the United Nations and said, we have four sources saying that the Iraqis have these mobile biological warfare laboratories. And I can remember the day that I first saw that report and thought, wow, this is an amazing report. I wonder if we'll actually be able to substantiate it. And then over the course of the next few weeks, we got three more reports in. Those four reports convinced me that the Iraqis had these mobile biological warfare labs. It was only after the war was over that the CIA came forward and said, well, actually, there was only just one source. But to try to disguise who it was, they had made it seem like it was four sources.
Hmm. So what do you say to the skeptics listening now who are wondering, well, if we got it so wrong on Iraq, why should we believe the stuff in his new book on Iran?
Well, first, the new book on Iran is a very different book, and I've got a big section in there called The Case Against Invading Iran. So it's not as if I'm making the same argument. Second, look, the only thing that you can ever do when you make a mistake is admit that you made the mistake, try to figure out what you did wrong, and move forward from there. And I have tried to do that. And for those who are interested, I had a big piece in the Atlantic Monthly earlier this year where I went through exactly the stuff that I was just talking about.
Yes.
Why was it that we got the intelligence on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction so wrong? How do we prevent it this time? And in the case of Iran, I am concerned about Iran's nuclear weapons program. I talk about what to do about it in the book. I don't think that a military solution is the right answer for Iran. And what's more, in the case of Iran, it is a very different problem because the Iranians have admitted that they're doing all of this stuff. I mean, unlike the Iraqis, who all along tried to pretend that they did not have any of these programs, even when they did, in the case of the Iranians, they were discovered and they have since come forward and they said, we are mining uranium and we are trying to convert uranium ore into what's called yellow cake. And we are taking yellow cake and turning that into uranium hexafluoride. And we are taking uranium hexafluoride and turning that into highly enriched uranium.
But isn't there still a major difference between the Iranian government position and the position of the IAEA and I guess the United States government, which is that Iran says it's doing all these things only for non-military nuclear energy purposes, and nobody believes them.
Correct. And you've, I think, summed it up very nicely, which is this is what they're saying. The IAEA takes no position on whether or not Iran is creating a bomb or not. That's a political decision. All they can say is, yes, we found the Iranians are doing all of these different things. And you're also right that no one believes them because there's no particular reason for them to be doing this unless they want a nuclear weapon. And what's more, we've had any number of Iranian officials over the course of time saying, we have every right to possess nuclear weapons. The Israelis have them, the Pakistanis have them, the Americans have them. We feel all these countries are a threat to us, so how can you deny them to us?
We'll get into the question of what right they may have to possess nuclear weapons, but what about the credibility then? I mean, you were just saying that one of the differences between Iran and Iraq is that Iran is declaring what it's doing, but I think we just established that Iran isn't declaring what it's really doing.
Well, they are declaring the steps that they're taking. Now, the big issue out there is, will they actually cross the nuclear threshold in terms of actually building a bomb, or will they simply have the capability to develop one? That's the debate that's going on in Iran today. No one knows what the answer to that is going to be, but there are a lot of Iranians who are saying, you know what, it would be a mistake for us to actually acquire the weapon. Let's just acquire the capability to build a weapon in short order if we need to do so. You know, from the perspective of the United States, from the perspective of Iran's neighbors, that's a distinction without a difference. Because if the Iranians have the capability to assemble a nuclear weapon in a matter of a few weeks, there's not a great deal of difference between that and them actually having the weapons ready to go.
93.9 and AM 820, WNYC and WNYC.org. My guest is Kenneth Pollack, well known for his pre-Iraq War book, The Threatening Storm, now the author of The Persian Puzzle, The Conflict Between Iran and America. We can take phone calls and emails for him. Our email box is always open, Brian Lehrer Show at WNYC.org. Our phones are now open at 212-267-WNYC, 267-9692, and we'll also talk with him about the Middle East after Yasser Arafat. Let's get to your case against going to war with Iran. You argue in the book that the U.S. should not consider war against Iran, even though their ties with anti-U.S. terrorists are much stronger than even you thought Iraq's were before the war, and even if they go all the way and develop actual nuclear weapons. Why not?
First, just one correction. This is very important to me. In The Threatening Storm, I made very clear I did not believe that the Iraqis had significant ties to terrorists. In fact, the opening line of that book was that, I'm paraphrasing myself now, there are no ties between Iraq and Al-Qaeda and Iraq and 9/11.
Right, and that's what I was referring to, and I'm sorry if I gave a misimpression, and I do remember very clearly when you were on this program that was the big caveat you had to the Bush administration's argument at the time.
Right.
So we'll both be very clear about what you weren't arguing there. So
let's get on with the question, though. Right.
So, but that's the contrast that I was making,
right,
that Iran does have more documented ties with terrorists interested in the United States, and it appears to be on the road to developing nuclear weapons. So why would somebody who thought that Iraq was worthy of invasion under those circumstances not think Iran might be?
Because of the difference in how the two leaderships have behaved, and it is a very important issue. What concerned me most, and what concerned all of the Iraq experts, I'd say, most about Saddam Hussein, was a pattern of reckless aggressiveness. And the word reckless there is what's really incredible, really important. Saddam, over the course of his period in power, had just made one foolish, aggressive decision after another that had resulted in catastrophic tragedy for Iraq. Since the death of Ayatollah Khomeini, you can't say that about the Iranian leadership. When Khomeini was there, the Iranians had the same problems that the Iraqis did. Khomeini did not live in the real world. He was fully capable of taking decisions that were tragic for Iran. Since his death, the people who've ruled in Tehran are still anti-American and they are still aggressive, but they have demonstrated a tremendous degree of prudence. They probe, they look for opportunities, but whenever they feel resistance, they pull back. Whenever they feel like they've gone too far, they reverse course. There is a degree of prudence in Iran that makes me much more sanguine that Iran would behave responsibly with a nuclear weapon and could be deterred. Now, that's not a, you know, there's no guarantees in this world, so that's not a certainty. But I think the other thing that you have to keep in mind when you talk about the possibility of should we go to war with Iran to prevent them from getting a nuclear weapon is not just this this track record where the Iranians have demonstrated that while they may not like us, they're not necessarily likely to go off half-cocked. Mm-hmm. There's also the costs. You know, the costs of the Iraq war, obviously, they've been much greater than predicted. I would argue they never had to be this high, and most of the costs that we're incurring right now are because of how poorly we went to war, both in terms of international support and not having any plans or resources in place to deal with the post-war conflict. But in the case of Iran, I think that the likely, even the best-case scenarios for post-war Iran would be far worse, far more costly, both in terms of resistance from the Iranians, the kind of insurgency we'd face, and just the size of the problem of rebuilding this country. It would dwarf what we're going through with Iraq right now.
I want to alert our listeners to a little schedule change for us this hour. If you've been listening since before the news, you know that we were talking about lingering questions regarding the vote in Ohio before Kenneth Pollack came on. And we were trying to get the journalist Greg Palast, who's raising some of those questions, as one of the guests in that segment, and he couldn't make it before then. We're going to have Greg Palast in about 15 minutes from right now, since we finally got in touch with him. So if you were interested in that topic, Greg Palast coming up in 15 minutes. Until then, Kenneth Pollack, author of The Persian Puzzle, The Conflict Between Iran and America. And let's take a phone call. Here is Patrick listening on the satellite in Westlake Village, California. Hi, Patrick. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yes. First, a quick comment. Earlier in the program, the author said that we were getting sources, intelligence sources, talking about WMD, but they didn't tell us they were coming from Chalabi. I think that's really sad if we need to depend on our intelligence sources to tell us the truth. I mean, you have to check out that a little thoroughly. I mean, that's not really an excuse. But really, I want to get my question is, what's the possibility that Israel will take proactive action to take out some of Iran's growing nuclear program? And if that happens, I want to know what will be the U.S. response. Will we stand on the sidelines or will we join? And could there be, if Iran already has nuclear weapons, could the conflict become nuclear?
Patrick, thank you for the question. Kenneth, we have 30 seconds before a break. Go ahead and give us the beginning of an answer.
Sure. Very quickly, I think it's unlikely that the Israelis are going to take any action against Iran. The Israelis would love to do so, but the problem is the Iranians have learned the lessons from Iraq, from Israel's successful strike against the Oseraq reactor. Their program is much bigger than the Iraqi program was at that time. It is dispersed, it's hardened, it's dug in, and they've shown a tremendous ability to keep entire facilities secret. Beyond that, Israel's got a big problem. They are over 1,000 miles away from Iran. They've only got 25 planes that could reach those Iranian targets. That's not enough to destroy the number of nuclear facilities that even we know about at this point in time.
We have to take that break. We'll follow up on this after the break and ask you about Israel after Arafat on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Ken Pollack, author of The Persian Puzzle, The Conflict Between Iran and America. Journalist Greg Palast coming up in 10 minutes on his assertion that there were so many irregularities in the vote in Ohio that, in his opinion, Kerry did, in fact, actually win. But Ken Pollack, what do you see as the U.S.'s options for how to get involved with a post-Arafat Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
I think the people we need to reach out to most quickly are the other big Arab states, in particular the Egyptians, the Saudis, to a certain extent. The Jordanians also have a tremendous amount of influence there. It's going to be very difficult to to guide the Palestinians. And right now we're in a situation where the Palestinians have got to find a new leadership. In many ways, it's all to the good that Arafat is no longer on the stage. He was a major impediment to moving forward either with peace with Israel or reforming the Palestinian Authority. Both of those things need to happen, but the problem is he was so successful in fragmenting the Palestinian leadership to prevent them from moving against them. We're likely to see a power struggle, and the question is simply whether the power struggle will be conducted in a gentlemanly fashion and we'll have a new leadership emerge, or whether it's going to be conducted with guns and rockets in the streets of Ramallah and Gaza.
What do you think?
I honestly, at this point, I give it 50-50 chance either way, and I think the key ingredient there is whether these other Arab states are willing to step in and go to the different Palestinian groups who look to them for leadership and support, and whether they're willing to say to them, you guys need to get along, we will not support you if there is a war. If there is a war, in fact, we will do everything we can to hurt you. And under those circumstances, I think that the various Palestinian groups will realize they've got no choice but to work things out diplomatically.
We had a guest earlier who suggested that the neocons in the Bush administration are going to lose a lot of power in the second term, especially with respect to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, because Bush will basically see that he has no choice but to go the more realist, quote-unquote, route. Do you think that's the case? And, you know, get more involved and more involved in almost Clinton-style peacemaking. Do you see that?
I'm skeptical. I've been saying since day one of this administration that they have got to take the peace process seriously. They've got to get engaged there, that it is killing us all throughout the region, including what we're trying to do in Iraq now, by not having done so. But that said, you know, this administration, both in terms of its political base, but also in terms of its perspective on the world, doesn't see the peace process as terribly important. They see it as kind of a sideshow. They're very comfortable in their relationship with Ariel Sharon. And, you know, they came to office believing that Bill Clinton wasted 8 years and got nothing but heartache for his involvement with the Palestinians. That was a critical element in their decision not to get deeply involved in the Israeli-Palestinian issue right from the get-go. I don't see that changing.
What's Iran's relevance to the Israeli-Palestinian situation, or the Israeli-Palestinian situation's relevance to Iran?
I'll take the second part first, which is that our ability to create a broad coalition, Middle Eastern states, European states, our allies in Asia like the Japanese, and get them to be willing to get tough with the Iranians, which is absolutely critical at this moment in time. To a certain extent, that's predicated on our willingness to get realistic about the peace process. All of those states would be much more comfortable helping us on Iran if we would actually take action and get a peace process going. And that doesn't mean selling Israel down the river. That doesn't mean unduly pressuring them. It simply means getting more active and trying to get something started there. In terms of Iran's relevance to the peace process, Iran has demonstrated it can play a spoiler role. There are many Iranian leaders who are fundamentally opposed to the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. Let's remember, in 1996, they were instrumental in helping defeat Shimon Peres by having Palestinian Islamic Jihad mount those awful terrorist attacks, which drove a lot of the Israeli populace into the arms of Bibi Netanyahu. And, of course, Netanyahu is much more skeptical about making peace with the Arab states than Peres was. Whether or not Peres would have gotten elected anyway, it is very clear the Iranians played a major spoiler role. They can do it again. Their ties to Hezbollah, their ties to Palestinian Islamic Jihad, to a lesser extent some of the other Palestinian groups. If they want to make trouble in Israel, they have ways to make trouble.
Mary in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Kenneth Pollack.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
I'm an American, but I'm married to an Iranian, and I have been going back and forth between the two countries for the past couple of years. And I think that the problem with a lot of these political solutions is they just never take the people into account. The Iranian people are so overwhelmingly pro-U.S. And for them, this nuclear power plant is really a symbol of modernization, plus their air pollution is atrocious. And it for them, it's like a way to move into the future. I think that Bush has been so aggressive towards the Middle East that that's kind of getting their back up, and now they're getting very defensive, and that's why you're starting to hear rumblings even from the people about why shouldn't we have a nuclear weapon. But it's really a pride issue, and I think that if we handled it differently, I mean, when I go to Iran, I feel so much more positive about the world because the people there, you know, they're not even very anti-Israel. They're very neutral on it, and I think they start to realize that the government's anti-Israeli opinions is really just to distract from the really, really poor job that government is doing.
Ken Pollack, do you share her assessment of Iranian popular opinion?
Oh, absolutely. Mary's points are excellent, and they're very important in kind of filling out a richer understanding of the dynamic between the two countries. You know, Mary's absolutely right. One of the great ironies we face right now is that probably the most pro-American population in the entire Muslim Middle East is in Iran, our greatest adversary, whereas the populations of so many of our allies in the Muslim Middle East are deeply anti-American. She's also right that the line that the Iranian government has been using with their people is, look, we need this for our power needs. In point of fact, that's very much a red herring. Iran is the second largest natural gas reserves in the world. Natural gas is a much cleaner, more efficient way to produce energy than these nuclear power plants that they're talking about building. Even if they did want to go the nuclear route, they could be building light water reactors, which are much, much more difficult to turn into bomb factories than the route that they're going. So there are problems between the government and the people. The people do, and there's tremendous pride among Iranians. They want to see themselves as one of the first-rank powers of the world. They want to be able to have access to all the technology.
But do you think then that that's what they're, if it is a nuclear weapons program, is about, pride, rather than any strategic positioning in the world?
No, I think that I think pride is there, but I think it's a secondary issue. For the Iranian people, I think very much pride is probably the first issue. For the Iranian government, I think that it is principally a defensive program in the sense that they are very frightened that the United States or Israel or Pakistan is going to attack them. But the U.S. first and foremost.
Pakistan?
Conceivably. They are nervous about the Pakistanis. The relationships have gotten cooler over the last few years, and they also worry about Pakistan collapsing. The Iranians don't like al-Qaeda, and they know that Pakistan was the greatest backer of the Taliban and al-Qaeda throughout the 1990s.
And Iran currently does have U.S. troops on one side of it in Afghanistan and on the other side of it in Iraq.
Yeah, in fact,
does it feel threatened by that?
No question, they do. And they also face the U.S. Fifth Fleet in the Persian Gulf. There are American soldiers in Central Asia on its northern border. They very much feel surrounded, and they feel like the United States is going to come to get them. Now, that said, of course, the Iranians have done a lot to create that situation. They've made enemies of a lot of people around them. They made enemies of us when they didn't necessarily need to do so. And one of my concerns about Iran getting nuclear weapons is, while they may be getting them for reasons of prestige and defense, they want to deter a U.S. attack, the problem is, once they've got them, will they suddenly see these weapons as allowing them to be more aggressive? This is effectively what happened with the Pakistanis. They wanted nuclear weapons to deter India. But once they got the nuclear weapons, they suddenly decided that it was such an effective deterrent against either an Indian nuclear or conventional retaliation that it allowed them to be much more aggressive with their own terrorist and insurgent operations against India. And that created the Kargil crisis in 2000, which almost sparked a nuclear war between India and Pakistan.
So to get back to an idea that you raised earlier in the program, do you think Iran has a right to nuclear weapons? And do you think that a nuclear Iran would not really be a threat to the United States, and the United States is altogether too worried about it?
I don't think that Iran has a right to nuclear weapons. I don't think that right necessarily exists. And what's more, they've signed the Nonproliferation Treaty, which says that they've given up. If they had such an inalienable right, they have alienated it. They have given it up. As far as them being a threat, I do see the Iranians as a potential threat. I don't think that it is the same kind of threat as either Saddam Hussein with a nuclear weapon or Osama bin Laden as a nuclear weapon, because, as I said, I think that Iranian decision-making has shown a much greater degree of prudence, more along the lines of, you know, what we saw from the Russians during the Cold War. But I don't think that we can be certain about that. That's why I think that there are a lot of things that we can be doing to try to head off this nuclear program, move them in a much more positive direction. I'd like to see us take that course. And the point that Mary made earlier is also a very important one, which is so much of the problem has been with how the Bush administration has approached the issue of Iran with our allies. In many cases, our allies are amenable to some of these ideas, and unfortunately, they're just so angry at the Bush administration as to how they've handled Iran, Iraq, so many other issues, it's soured the relationships.
Kenneth M. Pollack, best-selling author of The Threatening Storm Before the Iraq War, and a think tanker at the Brookings Institution, formerly in President Clinton's National Security Council, is now the author of The Persian Puzzle, The Conflict Between Iran and America, published by Random House. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Great to be here. Thanks for having me on.